Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And it's easy to get numb or to normalize everything when the news is so intense day after day. But there are two developments in national politics today that can both be called historic without it being hyperbole. One is the triumph of Stacey Abrams in the Democratic primary for governor of Georgia. She becomes the first African-American woman ever nominated by either major party to be governor of a state.
We are writing the next chapter of Georgia's future, where no one is unseen, no one is unheard, and no one is uninspired.
The other story of historic significance is that a president under investigation for obstruction of justice is launching an investigation of the investigation. President Trump has managed to wrangle a situation where the Justice Department that's investigating him is now also investigating its investigation of him. He may use details of the second investigation, legitimately or not, to stifle the first investigation. A constitutional crisis, a real constitutional crisis, may be around the corner. With us first today is New York Times White House correspondent Julie Hirschfeld Davis. And then Julie will stay on with us with filmmaker Liz Garbus, the documentary filmmaker, who is directing Showtime's new four-part docuseries, The Fourth Estate, about how the Times covers Trump while the president constantly refers to the paper as failing and its content as fake news. Julie, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And let me start with Stacey Abrams. The choice for Georgia Democrats was between two progressive women named Stacey, Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans. Why does it look to you that Stacey Abrams won?
Well, as you said, it's a really historic thing. She's now the first black woman to be a major party candidate for governor, and she would be the first black woman governor of Georgia if she won. She and Stacey Evans were making two pretty different bets about what would work in terms of winning the election among Democrats in Georgia. Stacey Evans was more focused on sort of moderate, middle-of-the-road voters, and Stacey Abrams basically really worked the, you know, work to get the black turnout up to really appeal to progressives in Georgia, but also cast a wider net than Democrats in the state have been able to successfully before, and not only really ran up the vote count in African-American areas and places where the black vote is very important, but also in some of the suburbs and the places in northern Georgia where Democrats have had a harder time in primaries. And so the fact that she could do both seems to have put her over the top, and it's going to make for a very interesting general election there.
And it seems the the path to victory that the Democrats and Stacey Abrams are going to attempt in Georgia, as you were indicating, is not to try to appeal to white swing voters who may not exist in large numbers right now in this polarized time, and particularly in Georgia, as opposed to turnout strategy aimed at young progressive whites and people of color generally who might be energized pro-Abrams or anti-Trump. I'm curious, and by the way, I should also throw in there that Trump only beat Clinton by 5 points in Georgia, which is less than in some traditional swing states like Ohio. So for you as a White House correspondent, does the nomination of Abrams for governor and whatever turnout bump or just attention to that race in the fall potentially takes place, could it have spillover implications for the president or for control of the House?
Well, I think what Republicans and Democrats are both trying to figure out right now is the degree to which Trump and the Trump effect is going to sort of spill over into these congressional races and into some of the statewide races like the governor's race in Georgia. And the issue is, the problem, I think, for Republicans is that there is a lot of intensity on the Democratic side, a lot of negative feeling about the president, a lot of worry and fear. And, you know, Democrats, I think, like Stacey Abrams, have calculated that, you know, they need to really sort of work on getting those people out, because those people are going to vote Democratic and they're going to be the difference between victory and loss for Democrats in the fall. And so I think, you know, at least last night indicates that she's done an effective job of that so far. If she can sort of replicate that, and Democrats in congressional races all over the country can do that, that's going to be a big problem for Republicans, and the White House is very clear about that. And the problem, the other issue for Republicans is that while President Trump has his own sort of cohort of very, very intense Republican supporters that doesn't seem to be going away, it's not clear the degree to which that's transferable to other Republicans. So if Stacey Abrams can run up the vote among progressives who are very skeptical and upset about the direction of the country, and Republicans can't correspondingly turn out their base, that's going to be an issue. And I think that'll be really a microcosm of the debate that's going to be going on in all the races we look at this fall.
Now, listeners, we're going to turn to the investigation news with White House correspondent for the New York Times, Julie Hirschfeld Davis. But I wonder if anybody listening right now is in Georgia or from Georgia, or any African-American or anyone else who feels that this is a historic moment, even the nomination of Stacey Abrams to be the Democratic candidate for governor of Georgia. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you want to put some Georgia or national historical context on us, on this for us listeners, 212-433-9692. So, Julie, on the investigation, you reported the other day on the president demanding an inquiry into whether the FBI under Obama during the 2016 campaign surveilled the Trump campaign in any way that was political. But I don't see evidence that they've come forward with to indicate it was political, rather than there was reason to suspect four of his campaign people, Carter Page and Papadopoulos and Manafort and who was the other one?
I believe it was Rick Gates.
Rick Gates were having illegal contacts with Russia. What are the Trump people even claiming as they try to distract from the facts of the Russia investigation itself?
Well, they're not trying to claim like that they have proof of this. The president hasn't, you know, produced any proof of the accusations he's making. His personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, actually was on TV last week saying, you know, he doesn't know for sure whether there was an informant or not. But that doesn't matter. That's sort of not the point of this exercise. The president has convinced himself and wants to convince the public that this was a nefarious, politically motivated, indeed criminal move by the government that was directed by Barack Obama and his people who were running the Justice Department at the time when this investigation was launched. And that's the theory. And he is really ratcheted up this morning. He's calling it Spygate. He's tweeting out witch hunt again. And he's really sort of turned this, what was a sort of large and sprawling but pretty traditional federal law enforcement investigation into what sounds like a really, you know, a sort of a conspiracy theory, like a black helicopter, they're all spying on me type of situation. So proof and evidence is sort of beside the point, although they are one of the sort of what was behind his tweet over the weekend on this and the meeting that he had about it at the White House on Monday with Rod Rosenstein from the Department of Justice and Chris Wray from the FBI is he is now basically gotten the Justice Department to share some information with White House officials and Republicans in Congress who want to see some of what the basis is for the special counsel investigation. So he doesn't have any proof, but he's trying to get some proof. And I think that's the point of that exercise.
Let's take a phone call right now on the Stacey Abrams nomination from Desmond in Brooklyn. Hi, Desmond. You're on WNYC.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I just was on the phone with my sister-in-law. She's down in Georgia. And she told me that everyone down there is proud of her, of Stacey Abrams, and that there has been a substantial amount of negative politicking on black or black-themed radio stations. They're running ads all day long that basically do not support her and tell lies about her. And one thing that most people are waiting for is to see if Stacey Evans, the person who she defeated in the Democratic primary, is going to throw her support behind Stacey Abrams.
Oh, is there any doubt about that?
It's Georgia politics. We'll see.
I hear you. Desmond, thank you very much. And our phones are still open, 212-433-WNYC. Back to the investigation, Julie. Some of the focus now is on an informant who the FBI apparently used to have conversations with some of those suspected Trump campaign officials. He is a retired American college professor living in the UK who had taught at Cambridge and worked for three Republican presidents, Nixon, Reagan, and Ford. And this meeting that you mentioned tomorrow between Justice Department officials and Republican congressional leaders is in part to share secret information about him. Why is he an issue?
Well, he's an issue because we recently discovered that he existed. My colleagues and others, folks at the Washington Post reported on it last week, and the president really seized on that as evidence, essentially, that he was spied on, that this was sort of illegally carried out, and to try to discredit the investigation and say, well, the fruits of all of this can't be trusted because this was a horrible thing to do. In fact, having an FBI informant in a big investigation like this is not at all uncommon. And we've since learned that the reason that this informant was dispatched to be involved in the investigation is because they had information that Trump campaign aides had had contacts with the Russians, and they wanted to figure out, well, what was this? Was this accidental? Was this criminal? Was this something else altogether? And so that's why they used this informant. So, but the existence of this person really piqued the suspicion of the president, and he has been pressing, and his allies on Capitol Hill have been pressing to find out who he is, what he might have been after, who sent him, that sort of thing. And that did prompt, that was part of what prompted the scheduling of this meeting. Although I should say, Republicans on Capitol Hill have been, at the behest of the president, have been pushing for many, many weeks for more documents, more classified information about the special counsel investigation. And they've sort of had a back and forth with the Justice Department, which up until this week has stood very firm against sharing any of that information. This is an ongoing investigation. But now, I think to avoid a bigger confrontation between the Justice Department and the president, they've agreed to at least share some of it. And I assume that at least part of what they will be discussing in a secure environment appropriate to sharing classified information is, information about this informant.
Right. Now, if this is supposed to be an honest effort to get at the truth, it's suspicious that the Justice Department officials are only going to share the information about this informant and about how the investigation got started with Republicans. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders defended that one-party policy yesterday in this clip.
To my knowledge, the Democrats have not requested that information, so I would refer you back to them on why they would consider themselves randomly invited to see something they've never asked to.
So, Julie, now Chuck Schumer, of course, the senator from New York and Senate Minority Leader, is asking. The Democrats think the whole thing is illegitimate, but as long as information about an informant who's already been outed is being shared with any members of Congress, they say it should be shared with people from both parties. So do you expect the Republicans to at least acknowledge that much and allow Democrats in the room?
I really don't know. I mean, this is extraordinary. Normally, in a setting like this, and particularly with these congressional committees, the ones that deal with intelligence and criminal investigations, they're very bipartisan. And, when they make requests for documents, when they ask for testimony, it's very often that the Republican and the Democrat band together, whoever is in charge of Congress at the time, and say, we both want this, you have to deliver it. They often do briefings, bipartisan briefings. But that has all broken down in a big way over the last several months and surrounding the special counsel investigation. It's become very partisan. The Republicans have made very little secret of the fact that they are sort of siding with the president on this. And so I really don't know what to expect in terms of whether they're going to allow Democrats in. And if they don't, it would just be an extraordinary development, because the whole pretext of this exercise is that they're trying to figure out whether this special counsel investigation is politically motivated. And to do that in a partisan way where you're cutting out one of the parties is just, it seems absurd. But I wouldn't, given how things have gone on this issue over the last several months, where Republicans really have gone their own way on this and cut Democrats out, and Democrats, to be fair, have been, you know, quite outspoken about the fact that they think the investigation is uncovering real evidence of wrongdoing by the president. So, you know, everyone knows where everyone else is coming from, but, you know, it does seem like it's this sort of environment where you could have Republicans say, no, you know, we refuse to share this information with Democrats, or if they're going to look at it, they're going to have to look at it separately from our review of it.
So we are getting a phone call from somebody in Georgia on the Stacey Abrams nomination. So here is Mary in Peachtree City. You're on WNYC. Hi from New York, Mary.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Okay, thank you.
Long-time listener. I've been down in Georgia for 4 years, but still listen to you every day.
Great. Thank you so much.
I did vote for Stacey Abrams, and I'm very excited to have her. And I did just want to say, we're not waiting to see about Stacey Evans. I did see on our local news last night that she is throwing her full support behind Stacey Abrams, and I'm very excited about that.
I thought that
we
was the case,
here.
And I'm not surprised to hear that. I'm curious, for you as a Georgian and with one foot in New York, if there's any kind of racist backlash that you would expect to see in anti-Abrams turnout or any other way, separate from the Republican electorate policy differences with any Democrat who might be running for governor, or compared to if Stacey Evans had been the nominee. Are you thinking about that?
Of course I am. You know, it is hard for me to say because I am right in the Atlanta metro area, which is a little, you know, very a lot more progressive than the rest of the state of Georgia that I'm not so familiar with. But unfortunately, it runs deep down here. And I'm a New Yorker. I'm from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So it is something hard for me to get used
right.
to being down here.
And of course, Atlanta is such a major and diverse city with many Latino and Asian immigrants, not just the Old South white and black electorate. And I guess that is a big reason that Georgia could be turning from red to purple, right?
I certainly hope so.
Mary, thank you so much for your call. And
thanks, Brian.
Julie, getting back to the investigation, is constitutional crisis a possibility? And by that I mean not just politicizing everything, but an actual standoff over who has the authority to continue or call off or restrict the Mueller investigation. That's where I think the words constitutional crisis would really apply.
Right. Well, when the president brought up this idea of demanding another investigation on Sunday, that was the idea that was the problem that initially leapt to the minds of a lot of the legal experts and others I talked to, that essentially it's pretty clear that the president has the power to ask for an inquiry by the Justice Department. But when it comes to an ongoing special counsel investigation of the president himself, that involves the president himself, it was also very clear to these folks that the Justice Department could not, in good conscience, say, okay, we are going to go ahead and do the personal bidding of the president in this case. So the question is, well, if they weren't able to do that, then what would happen? And that's where you get into the potential for a sort of Saturday night massacre type situation where you have people at the Justice Department saying no to something, potentially being fired by the president or resigning instead of carrying out his order. And then, you know, that could cascade pretty quickly, you could see, into a really bad situation where you have a constitutional crisis and a real confrontation between the president and his own Justice Department.
All right. Now, folks, we'll do something a little different with New York Times White House correspondent Julie Hirschfeld Davis. Julie will stay on, and we will add filmmaker Liz Garbus, who is directing Showtime's new four-part docuseries, The Fourth Estate, which is about how the New York Times covers Donald Trump, while the president constantly refers to the paper as failing and its content as fake news. So Liz Garbus will join Julie Hirschfeld Davis after the break. Stay with us.